Welcome to the Theology Mill, brought to you by Wittfenstock Publishers. I'm your host, Zach Mickle. In this podcast, we interview some of the leading authors in theology, biblical studies, philosophy, and more. Many of the folks we talk with are also authors with us at Wittfenstock, where we have the honor of putting into print a broad swath of work which nourishes both the academy and the church. On this episode, I interview Dr. Anne M. Carpenter. Dr. Carpenter is a professor of theology at St. Mary's College of California and the author of Theopoetics, Hans Urs von Balthasar, and the Risk of Art and Being. She also has quite the Twitter following, so if you've not checked out her Twitter, I would highly recommend doing so because she's quite hilarious. But in our interview, Professor Carpenter and I discuss Hans Urs von Balthasar for our Balthasar booth, particularly in relationship to poetry, Orientalism, Heidegger, Thomism, theological risk-taking, and much, much more. So with that, friends, let's jump on over to the interview. All right, let's jump right into Balthasar. So my first question is maybe what impresses you the most about von Balthasar as a theologian?
So to me, one of the things that's most interesting about him is how hard he is to fit onto an ideological team. He stands apart from most groups, partly methodologically, because he's creating a kind of hybrid theology that methodologically expands the kinds of tools theologians can use and borrow. And so he's exploring what that hybrid theology might look like. And he uses, of course, all kinds of resources to do it, and it helps to know the resources he knows. It's hard to keep track, but for me, I find that methodological edge the most interesting, and how hard he is to really place on a team.
Okay, let's go on to the next question, which is, on the other side of the coin, maybe what's one critique you might make of Balthasar and his theological project?
Yeah, you gave me this question in advance, so I've been thinking about it. And I think one of Balthasar's weaknesses is when he speaks about the East, especially Eastern religions, it's really not until very late in his career that he's able to distinguish the East, so Buddhism, from the Orientalism that he would have been in the air in Europe when he was growing up. And so for most of his career, when he brings up Buddhism, for example, he's going to eventually talk about Hegel. But they're not in fact related. They're just related to one another in a sort of European Orientalist context. And so that's a tendency of his that I think can really distract scholars. And there's been really good work on that issue in particular, actually, recently. But it's definitely a problem that he has.
That's really interesting. That's definitely not what I was expecting you to say, but that's really interesting. Okay, let's move on to
Joshua Brown is the one I was thinking of who writes on this.
Joshua Brown. Okay. Yeah. And link that at the bottom of the interview. Awesome. Okay. So for those who are new to von Balthasar, obviously he's written so many books, and they're kind of so varied that it's hard to know where to begin. So where would you say is maybe a good starting point, or maybe a couple starting places for people as far as books of his that they could read, and then maybe like some secondary sources as well, if you have any.
Yeah. So let's see. I think pretty much any angle with Balthazar will work as long as you keep reading. But for people totally unfamiliar with him, his shorter books and his exploration in theology essays, so there's these several volumes of topical essays, give a more focused Balthazar who's easier to understand. So of the shorter books, I might highlight Mysterium Paschale, which is both prototypical Balthazar, but also very focused and methodologically clear. And of the explorations essays, maybe start with volume one. He's got some really interesting things to say about scripture, spirituality, tradition, beauty in those essays.
Awesome. Thank you for that. Yeah, it's interesting because we interviewed Matthew Levering and he listed like six books that people could start with. Which of course is like very Balthazarian, but they were all a bunch of shorter works. But he didn't bring up Mysterium Paschale, somebody mentioned that one too. Okay. As far as your own favorite book by Von Balthazar, what would you choose and why?
So I really appreciate most of his work. And so it depends on what I'm thinking about at the time. One of my favorite books lately is the much neglected Theologic Volume 3, which closes out his trilogy. It's got some of the most interesting work on the Trinity that he does at length. And so I'm quite fascinated by it.
Okay. Let's see. Let's talk about maybe your poetry, right? So you're not just but also poet. And in your book, you begin each chapter with a poem of your own, which are wonderful, by the way. So maybe, tell me a little bit about kind of what brought you to poetry in general, kind of how you've cultivated that skill over time.
Yeah, I have a kind of funny, odd story to tell about it, because when I first arrived to graduate school in theology, I was really fascinated by this theologian, Hans Urs von Balthasar, and I had no idea he had written the Theological Aesthetics. And at the time, I hated all of the arts passionately. But I thought it was a motivism wrapped in niceness, and I had no interest in it. And so I was very upset to learn that my hero had written a Theological Aesthetic. So what was that? And at the same time, I had a good friend who noticed that I was good at writing and had a sort of talent for images and words and sounds, and that I was very experimental with these without sort of realizing that was what I was doing. And so he taught me about poetry and had me read poems for the first time outside of an educational setting. And I finally was able to understand more about the way poetry operates, how it means what it means, and the richness with which it means what it means. Mm-hmm. And it was like my fun secret side project for all of grad school. It was the thing no one was telling me to do that I was just learning about. It was like a brand new world. Because before then, poetry had been very closed to me, which it is for many people. And so I started experimenting and writing poetry during this time. And it was my advisors in graduate school who had me combine the two in Baltazar and sort of perform being an artist, but subordinating the artistic sensibility to theological method, to the theological horizon, you might say. And so I had to kind of like perform what Baltazar does while at the same time explaining what Baltazar does. And so they actually asked me to include poetry, which I didn't want to do because I thought it made me weird and I just wanted to be normal. I eventually each chapter got a poem that I wrote sort of in the mode of reflection of each chapter. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of like testimony to the person I became in those years, which was like learning to be a different kind of person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very in line with kind of what you're doing in your book, as far as talking about Baltazar, kind of drawing from poetry, drawing from the arts, but also expressing his theology in kind of a poetic manner. So yeah, so speaking of that, in your book, right, it's kind of fundamentally about the relationship between theology and poetry, or like being and beauty. One of your arguments is that his project is kind of distinct from the modern collapse of metaphysics into just manifestation, but also from this kind of cold and dusty metaphysics that's absent of like image. If his work is kind of distinct from those two extremes, I guess then how does he kind of relate theology and poetry?
Yeah, so I've always been very close with Thomists, at least Thomists of a certain kind. I was at Marquette, and so it was especially devotees of Bernard Lonergan. And they can be quite stringent Thomists. And so they really struggled to understand Baltazar, how he might make sense. He seemed beautiful but foolish to them, a kind of effervescence that was lovely to look at but ultimately contentless. This was very frustrating, of course, for me to endure. And so the Baltazar that I brought out in the book is the Baltazar who's very metaphysically serious, philosophically knowledgeable, and has a real grasp of Thomist metaphysics and its fundamentals as a sort of guiding frame for the work that he's doing and the speculation that he's doing. But Baltazar also sees image, repetition, illusion, so various methods that poetry uses. He also cites poets themselves, but even beyond that, he's also doing this other layer of work that's not just a philosophical exploration, sort of discursive, but also very imagistic and metaphorically rich, requires knowing the illusions he's making, just like a poem would understand what's going on And so those two modes of exploring theological questions are often happening simultaneously in Balthasar's texts. And they're not the same, but they're often taking place within the same overall argument. And so my task was to, on the one hand, distinguish the two, but on the other, to show the way Balthasar's theology of language, which I argued was ultimately Christological, allowed him to be, on the one hand, metaphysically serious, on the other hand, playful and precise in the ways that art is.
Yeah, I love that. So you and I know others have kind of made claims that Balthasar's project, I've heard this a lot in respect to like his trilogy, that it's basically a response to just kind of certain tendencies in modern philosophy. So in your book, you're kind of highlighting the influence of Martin Heidegger, the philosopher, and then the poet. I'm going to butcher this, but Rainier Maria Rilke. It's one of those names that I've read like 100 times, but have never actually heard it pronounced.
Rainier Maria Rilke.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. So you're kind of highlighting their influence on Balthasar's own thinking. So maybe describe kind of the role these two thinkers in particular played in kind of the development of his theological project.
Yeah. Balthasar has an interesting relationship to the modern world. In my book, sort of nuts and bolts research-wise, the major contribution that it gave in a lot of ways was I studied the early Balthasar, the Balthasar who wrote this enormous dissertation that eventually became a three-volume exploration of what he called the apocalypse of the German soul. And he deals with modern philosophers and poets to try and understand his present age. Because thinkers and artists are dealing with the materials of the age they live in. Mm-hmm. And so the story he tells about the West in that very early work is that its final word to the world is control. And that this is tragic and awful. That it comes from a kind of exhausted metaphysical tradition, but also a culture exhausted with itself, sort of staring in the face of a mirror and seeing nothing. So it's very much that interwar, because it was written between World War I and World War II, very much an interwar mode of thinking. And so this actually makes Balthasar's relationship to modern thought, on the one hand, very intimate. He's very curious about it. He reads it at length, thinks it's meaningful, that the church has to deal with it because it's the milieu of the individual Catholic. But if its final word is control, then it doesn't actually allow people their being alive, and certainly not their being alive for God is their ultimate goal. And so Cyril O'Regan talks about this. He talks about Balthasar re-remembering Christianity out from underneath a kind of an enormous misremembering of it, on the parts of major Western interlocutors that he has. And so Baltasar, he's got this hostility toward what he'll call Titanism, which is very modern. And by modern, he'll mean pretty much anything post the High Middle Ages onward, which is a very sort of Catholic way of talking. But it's also a key into his work, because he thinks there's value in, for example, the emphasis on the human individual, the human person that modernity values. He wants to borrow that and sort of baptize it and use it as a way into a Christianity that he wants to broaden out from a narrow, calcified, defensive theologizing that he grew up with. So that's the sort of larger backdrop. Mm-hmm. Heidegger and Rilke, which he pairs together as creatures of similar attitudes, are two people that whose work he really appreciates. And Rilke in particular, he loves. He loves Rilke's poetry, which is gorgeous. In the book, I actually translated it myself because I wanted to know what was beautiful about it in the German. And it's wonderful. But it's also the exaltation of death as the final status of being human. Like Rilke has this one line where he's talking about stars, and he says, "I believe that the stars whose light reach me now, whose light reaches me now, have been dead for thousands of years."
Wow.
Which is gorgeous and wonderful, and there's a certain profound despair underneath it as well. And so Heidegger is more of the problem for Baltasar. He appropriates aspects of Heidegger's thought that he finds useful as a way to triangulate toward human existentialism. But Heidegger, at least for Baltasar, and this is very much just Baltasar's Heidegger, there's a kind of nihilism that Heidegger is unwilling to admit, but Rilke will. Rilke's the brave one who will go there. And so, yeah, he's very, very influenced by them, but also different from them. And it can be an interesting challenge to see thinkers he has a close relationship with that he's also trying to, what do I want to say? He's trying to, on the one hand, borrow from, and on the other hand, critique.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I noticed in your book you quote Fergus Kerr, right, who calls Balthazar a Heideggerian Thomist, which is kind of funny because I feel like both Heideggerians and Thomists would like vehemently disagree with those identifications of Balthasar. But you seem to be like at least implicitly kind of agree with that assessment. So I guess in what ways would you say that Balthasar is Heideggerian, and in what ways would you say he's Thomist, and then how does he kind of bridge the two?
Yeah. I remember reading that in Fergus Kerr's essay, and he means it as an insult to Balthasar, really. He's not a fan of Balthasar's strange coherentizing together of Thomas Aquinas and Martin Heidegger. But I sort of flipped it into, well, what if it really is coherent what he attempts to do with Heidegger and Thomas? And so I explored that as a positive, creative contribution Balthasar makes. And so I emphasized, I mean, people are most interested maybe in Heidegger. As I said before, my interlocutors were Thomists. So I was very keen on getting the Thomism correct. And so Balthasar's basic stances on what truth is, how being operates, the relationship between created being and divine being, those are all just really ordinary interpretations of Thomas Aquinas. Mm-hmm. And so I brought those forward, which is sort of, being, created being, and its truth participates in being of God. And so for me to know truth is for me to affirm something, right? Truth is in the mind, Thomas Aquinas says. And Balthasar hooks together that notion of being and truth, particularly Thomas's notion of truth. Then he talked about how beauty is a kind of delight in the truth. So it's that delightful quality when you learn something.
Mm-hmm.
And he hooks that together with Heidegger on the expressiveness of being, truth as aletheia and unveiling, so that he can confront the material instantiations or expressions of beings using a kind of blend of Heidegger's truth as unveiling or expressive. Balthasar will say being is expressive, with a Thomist confidence in how that which expresses is knowable, really affirmable. And so, yeah, that was sort of my metaphysical work there, to show that he's coherently aligning the two without being beholden to either, except toward the ultimate goal of describing divine revelation.
Mm-hmm. It kind of brings us to our next question, which is, right, so you're kind of arguing in your book that Balthasar's theopoetic is comprised of like three massive fields of knowledge, right? So those fields of knowledge are metaphysics, language, and Christology, which that third one is really interesting. How would you say that Balthasar twines those three in forming his theopoetic?
Yeah. So Balthasar borrows the methodological procedures of metaphysical inquiry. So what is being? What is it to be? That sort of thing, philosophy. And of the arts, and he'll shift around which arts. I emphasized things like using images, interrelating images to one another, and allusion. So the methodological procedure of, say, poetry, which was my main example, but you could use others, to express how it means. He borrows that and metaphysical inquiry, but subordinates both to Christology. It's how he organizes them together, distinguishes them, but also relativizes them, because for Balthasar, the self-revelation of God has a kind of primacy, a governing meaning that's going to help him organize the ways that he trusts language to speak truth, even artistic language, without perplexing that expressiveness with Jesus Christ himself, the original fact, he'll call Jesus. And so, if I'm remembering rightly, in the book, I emphasized how Christology allows Balthasar to have these huge metaphysical questions. What is it to be? What's a human being? What are we talking about when we say salvation? What's a human freedom, if we want to call it free? But also a fascination with what's particular and irreplaceable, which is the person of Christ, but also the human person. No person is alike. And so it's impossible to generalize personness beyond the pure heuristic of no person is another. And so, Christology is kind of his way to care about details, but also just care about the huge questions.
Got it. I'm really interested in the subtitle of your book, right? Because it's Hans Urs von Balthasar and the Risk of Art and Being. So I'm curious kind of what you're getting at there. What do you mean by the risk of art and being? And kind of like what Balthasar's theological project has to do with that. And I'm especially curious about your use of the word risk there. So maybe you could tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So beauty dies, and beauty is untrustworthy. So on the one hand, beautiful things fade. Not just human beauty, but anything. They fade away. And so that part's a challenge, because if we're going to talk about beautiful and the eternal God, on that level, beauty is already a problem. But beauty can also be used to manipulate. Advertising is great for this. It creates desire. It tells us, don't you want this? And I think, oh yes, suddenly now I do want this. And it's beautiful. And so beauty can be deceiving. Balthasar himself says, there is no more demonic, transcendental being than the Kalon, the beautiful. And so Balthasar sets out to do a theological aesthetic, and he knows these two things about beauty and always has them in mind. And so he set out to do something that's really hard to somehow articulate a theology of beauty that's fully aware of the problems in doing so. And so, which is why he distinguishes between theological aesthetics, where you've got divine revelation running the show, and aesthetic theology, which is dominated with looking nice. It's not going to really be able to confront, for example, the ugliness of sin or the cross. Mm-hmm. And so that's the risk of art on a kind of macro level. And there's a further risk in his use of imagery in his theology, where people will think that he's not being technical when he is. So they'll take his images literally. So it's an incredible risk he takes to be misunderstood or to be taken the wrong way in this use of the beautiful and the arts. And he does it anyway. Similarly, when it comes to being, especially human beings, Balthazar wants us to risk existence, to risk existing, to decide by the light of grace to do what God wills for the good of the world, which is an immense risk fraught with all kinds of vulnerabilities. And maybe the most vulnerable of which is to love like God does. And so that asking for that kind of a commitment of kind of commitment to be, which is going to require the use of everything I have, which still won't be enough to do well. And yet that's the task, is to affirm being, to risk for it. And so to enrich it, to creatively enrich it. And so, at least for me, there's a kind of daring in Balthazar that is greatly underplayed, because we think beautiful things are nice things, and that being is easily understood. Whereas for him, there's this drama going on, which is to dare the beautiful and to dare being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for that. That really clarifies the language of risk. Because I think like one of the most common, or at least just a common critique I hear of Balthazar, is that because he's kind of poetic in his expression, that he's sometimes almost like blasphemous, or like at least ambiguous and definitely kind of provocative. But yeah, I like your point about, you know, kind of that poetic risk taking being sort of like fundamental to like how he does theology. So yeah, thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Let's do one more question and then we can close. You talked a bit about your forthcoming book with Fortress Press on a theology of tradition. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about that and kind of what you're doing with that book.
Yeah, thanks. So it's called Nothing Gained is Eternal, A Theology of Tradition. It comes out this September. And I have kind of three things that I do in the book. On the one hand, it's an introduction to the Catholic early 20th century, and its immense confrontation with history, with the idea that the church is subject to history, which was a moment of immense and very fraught conflagration for Catholics that I think Catholic theology is still living through that insight. And so I give a sort of tour of four important people in that confrontation. Bernard Lonergan, Hans-Urs von Balthasar, Maurice Blondel, and Charles Peggy. But I use each of these men to then argue for how tradition operates, what its basic operations are, and how they relate to one another. So it's also a speculation on the being of tradition. And then I take those people and that speculation, and I ask, well, what's its moral content when we know that Christians sin? They not only have a tradition, but they also sin in the world. And so I confront elements of Black theology, Black critical thought, to try and understand that element of Christian sin. And so it's a theology of tradition that introduces readers to major issues, but also takes a more abstracted stance in order to help practical problems ultimately. So that's what it is.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, that sounds delightful. Were you writing it in time that you got to kind of interact with David Bentley's Hart's new book on tradition and apocalypse?
No, I actually found out about his book as I was finishing the index of the upcoming.
Yeah, those would be interesting to read side by side.
Yeah, my book treats tradition as a fact, and his does not. So they're right. Quite different.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking some time to talk.
Thanks for listening to The Theology Mill, brought to you by Wittfenstock Publishers. If you liked what you heard and would like to hear more, you can subscribe to our show, where we have a lot more content coming your way. I'm your host, Zach Mickle, signing off on this episode of The Theology Mill. We hope to see you again to share a drink and talk all things theology. Until then, good friends, God bless, and we'll see you soon.